if I wanted to be a dishonest person, I'd go get a parts manager's job, and I could steal from just about any one of my clients over time and go completely undetected. So it's a huge vulnerability.
You're listening to Driving Performance, your go-to podcast for unmatched expertise in the world of buying and selling an automotive dealership. Each episode features discussions with industry leaders and is brought to you by Performance Brokerage Services, North America's premier family-owned automotive dealership brokerage firm with over 30 years of experience. We're here to ensure you gain the most reliable insights to confidently navigate a transaction and accomplish your unique goals. Whether you're looking to buy or sell, we prioritize building lasting relationships and maximizing the value beyond the transaction level. Here's your host, Jamie Farley, for another segment of Shifting Gears.
Welcome back to Driving Performance. I'm Jamie Farley, and I'm excited about our guest and our subject matter today. Our guest is Mark Payne, President and CEO of Total Dealer Solutions. Mark grew up in dealerships, starting in the parts department at 9 years old. He went on to become a Mazda dealer and then built a company that's been helping dealers tackle one of the most critical areas of the business, the parts department. Matt Willis is co-hosting with me today. Matt, welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you very much for having me. And we know firsthand the weight of the parts department and parts inventories and how they carry a large piece of the transaction. It can either strengthen confidence in the total transaction or the deal, and it also raises a lot of questions throughout. So we're excited to get a great conversation going with you, Mark, about the parts department and what you've done in the business.
Great. Sounds good. Looking forward to it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, welcome to the show, Mark. Happy to have you on. Very excited for this conversation. Can we start from the beginning, working in the parts department of your dad's store as a kid? That's fascinating. You started so young at age 9. What did those early experiences teach you and kind of what sticks with you today?
Well, ironically, the job was not parts. It was pulling weeds. And I happened to be, it started raining one day, and I loved as a kid, 9-year-old, getting in the cars in the showroom. So I was always, any chance I could get to hang out there, that's where I was at. And all of a sudden, my dad comes back from lunch and he sees me hanging out in the showroom. He goes, what are you doing? And I said, well, it's raining outside. He goes, oh, okay, follow me. Takes me back to the parts department, says, start dusting these parts bins. So that was my foray into the parts side of it. And what's funny is I never thought that that's where my ultimate career would end up, back there. So I've come full circle. And ironically, just I have flashbacks to that, those days when they had the computers back then. I'm not that old, but they were slowly migrating away from their card files. They held onto those card files for years. And what's interesting is it's still kind of similar that way today, but very, very slow to change. What that taught me was there's no standing around. There's always something to be done. And that was a lesson I learned right away, right quickly. And just that knowledge that I had over the years as I went through the business, that those experience of the time that I spent in the parts and service department, I also spent a lot of time in the front end of the dealership and sales and so forth. But what it taught me was that I was able to see that the parts and service is not really the back end, it's the backbone of the business. And many people have coined that term before, but it's very true. So I always kind of kept that in the back of my head. And when I purchased my Mazda dealership, I actually had an opportunity to buy a bunch of obsolete parts. And I bought them for 10 cents on the dollar, which I kind of was very leery about, but I did it. I thought it was a great deal. And then I spent a good year getting out of those parts. So it was, so there was a lot. And that's kind of where when I did sell the dealership, I saw a niche in the industry and kind of a void that I wanted to fill. And that was focusing on the parts side of it.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this. You wanted to buy the obsolete parts.
Yeah, well, because I was buying them at a huge discount. So, but caution, I did spend a year getting out of those parts. So if I really look back at it, now it was the Mazda dealership. So you have to eke every little penny out of everything to make it worthwhile. So the time that I was spending on that, there were a lot of things that I learned and a lot of issues and things that in talking with other dealers, all of a sudden I started noticing, like in my 20 group, things like that. I'm like, are you guys looking at this? Are you looking at this? Most of them are like, what are you talking about? So it was a very clear vision to me that I saw, and I ended up selling my dealership. And then, and when I sold it, that was where I had decided I wanted to fill that void in the industry, especially as consolidation was happening and so forth. I was seeing that there, you know, a lot of people coming up that are in upper level management are coming up from the front end, and there's a big lack of knowledge on the back end. And I always joke about it. You know, over the years since I've started this business, I've spoken at many 20 groups and things like that. And usually there's a cocktail party afterwards or what have you. And I can tell you this, I've never walked up to a group of dealers talking about how many parts they sold. So it's a very niche market, so to speak. So, but I've been able to really kind of harness it, and over the years build quite a business out of it, and serving a real need in the business. And especially when it comes to buy sells, I mean, that's a big one as well, which kind of, as you alluded to, it can be a big part of the transaction. And in many cases, I've seen it where it's blown up a transaction. So it's extremely important.
Mark, what ultimately led to you selling your Mazda store, and how did that help shape the rest of your career?
Well, so I graduated from Northwood University, which is an automotive. The whole curriculum is based around the dealership and the automotive industry. And so all my accounting courses, all of that, dealership financial statement was the basis for all that. So everything was very much focused and centered on that. Well, about 6 months out from graduating, my dad called me and said, I got good news and bad news. Good news is I've got a good deal on the dealerships. The bad news is I know that's all you've ever wanted to do, and now you have nothing to come back to. So it hit me pretty hard there for a few hours or so, but I at that point I was like, okay, well, I guess I got to go work for somebody else and instead of my dad. So it really actually became a blessing, and because I was able to have a fantastic relationship with my father, Leo Payne. When he sold, he had 17 dealerships in Denver. So he was kind of a pioneer in the business, just a hard worker, just a fantastic man. And one of the blessings was I was able to keep that father-son relationship as opposed to that business relationship, which I know he had a little difficult time separating that with a couple of my older brothers. So I'm just fortunate that it was a blessing in disguise to me, because it not only did it, I go on to have an amazing relationship with my father, who actually just passed away in March at 93 years old. So lived a good full life. And he was also inducted into the Colorado Automotive Hall of Fame. So that was good to see before he passed. But yeah, I was just able to have a really good relationship with him. And from that, I just went to work for other dealers, and I wanted to own my own dealership. And I had this goal set on myself to own it by the time I was 30. So I was really pushing hard. And finally, after working in a few stores, an opportunity came up, and it was a Mazda store, and it was in Miami. And it wasn't an ideal situation, but I figured it was kind of a thing that I could step into. And there was a 2-year lease left on the property. So the 10 dealers before me that had bought it hadn't been able to do anything with it. So I figured, I think I'm good, but you know, it's pretty risky. But I thought, well, let me see if I can duel it up with another franchise. And that was kind of my goal, but I had an exit strategy. So I ended up selling it because I couldn't get another franchise with it. I ended up selling it 2 years later, and the lease was up, sold the franchise, did well on that, had sold off the parts. So that was a good thing. So I was able to come whole on those. And really, when I sold it, I just realized that this was a great opportunity to go into the parts side of it. And after kind of, again, it kind of rekindled a lot of other lessons that I had learned in parts at a young age, and just thought nothing's really changed that much in this sector. And so that's when I started doing physical inventories for dealers. And a common problem happened of reconciling to accounting was a huge issue. So we eventually created a daily reconciliation program that works for dealers and solves that problem. And then obsolete parts is another problem, which we have a product that deals with that as well. So we've really been able to kind of look at this and say, what's our core focus? And that core focus is the parts. And again, at the buy sells, we've been able to really help some dealers avoid some pitfalls and so forth along the way. So
it sounds like solving all of these different problems along the way is kind of what helped evolve the company that you have today, Total Dealer Solutions. Would that be an accurate way to say it? And maybe just tell us like a little bit about the company and what dealers hire you for your services.
That was kind of the premise, is we have this issue and dealers kept coming to us with these problems and we kept uncovering these problems. So we simply said, let's help them solve them. Now, the reconciliation thing is a huge problem, and all dealers struggle with that, reconciling to accounting. And so again, we've mastered that and we built a program around it. So we have answers for dealers on that. And that's the hardest part is, you know, originally dealers had hired me if they had a large overage or shortage, they'd say, how do we figure out what that is? And they'd hire me to come in. After a couple times of doing that, I couldn't really pinpoint it. And I just said, listen, I can't charge you for something that I can't give you answers for. So I can't do this anymore. But I did know it was possible. I just had to figure out, you know, because it's math at that point. It's pretty straightforward. There's no gray area in accounting. You know, it took us a long time to do it, but we built a program around that and it's a great program. So, but solving the issues, that's the whole thing, right? You've got to find the problem. And then once you find that problem, you come up with a solution and you've got a good business plan. So
absolutely. Can you share a story where a condition of the parts department either strengthened or weakened the dealership's overall value of a buy-sell transaction?
Yeah, certainly. The best one, I've got a couple different scenarios, but probably the best one is the department was when we came in to do the physical inventory. And when we do it for a buy-sell, we're kind of prepping, we're getting the asset purchase agreement parts portion of that to interpret that, because the real value in our service anyway is that on the buy-sells, I actually personally make sure that on the buy-sells, I'm reviewing that report. I'm, in a lot of cases, creating that report and interpreting an asset purchase agreement because it's so important, and to make sure that we're able to get the data to them according to the asset purchase agreement as best as possible. And we always preface it with, we're not attorneys, so our interpretation is not word. It's, here's what we believe it is. It's up to you two parties to make sure that you both agree on that. Because the parts side of it can get so intricate. And attorneys are the ones writing the terms on this usually. And they don't really know anything about parts. So they like a returnability. Oh, well, if the part's returnable, then that's fine. We'll buy that as long as it's returnable. Well, might be returnable, but you have to have return credits in order to return it. So it doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, great, we'll buy this, no problem. So there's a lot of different things in there that we look at, but we make sure that we're able to do that. Now, when we, in a particular case, we're getting prepared, we started realizing, we were talking with the parts department about getting ready to come in to do the inventory. They said, yes, 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 this is done. And we were a little concerned on some of the data we were seeing, and we mentioned it to them, and they said, no, everything's fine, everything's perfect. And the parts manager's been there 30 years, and we've got no problems. But we get into it, we couldn't complete the inventory, it was so bad. And that, I mean, we couldn't confirm the accuracy, because you can't in 6 hours fix years of mismanagement of a parts department and the messiness of it. You've got to have every part into a bin location. You've got to have all the things that are parts need to be where the system says they are. So otherwise you're chasing them down and that becomes a complete mess. So if the department's not in good shape, in this particular case, it killed the deal, because what happened was there was a number of other factors that the buyer was kind of conceding on. And the parts, our job is the thing everyone is always waiting on at the closing. They're always waiting on. So I always get the flag. We're waiting on you. We're waiting on you. Well, it's not my fault. That's the way it lands. But that's just the nature of the beast, because we're doing the inventory usually the day before, or we're getting the numbers the night before, and then preparing a report and then sending them the information according to that. So by that time, when you get to that and that turns out to be a mess, and the inventory you couldn't really validate the inventory, you know, all these other concessions that the buyer made is like, you know what, I'm done. This is just too messy. And that was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back, and the deal blew up. So that's just one case.
So was it a lot of parts that just were never accounted for? So was it all this excess inventory, or was it obsolescence, or a combination thereof?
A little bit of everything. I mean, that's the crazy part. There's a lot of little, like, for instance, you kind of mentioned parts not where they're supposed to be, that kind of thing. But a parts manager will write off parts. For instance, let's say they create a list of parts that they want to write off. They give it to the general manager. They get approval to write them off. Well, they write them off, but they never take them off the shelf and dispose of them. So now inventory time comes around, and now all these parts are being added back into the inventory. Well, on a buy sell, that's a lot of obsolescence usually. Or if that's happening, that doesn't necessarily show up as obsolescence because it's showing up as it was just added into the inventory. So it's current inventory, when indeed it's really not. So those are all things to be cautious of and make sure. And those are things that can really mess up a deal or obsolescence. Another scenario was a store we were doing. They were closing. Obviously, we all know that if a deal doesn't close by December 15th, it's probably not going to. So we had a deal that was literally on December 15th, and it was a Nissan store. And the way the Nissan parts work is their returnability and their code. They have what they call J-coded parts, which are non-returnable. So those particular parts, while they were not J-coded on that day, they were going to turn into J-code parts at the end of the quarter, because that's how Nissan works, is at the end of the quarter, these part numbers move into that bucket of whatever classification. So these were J-coded. These weren't J-coded parts at the time of inventory or the time of the closing, which means that the dealer was about $45,000 worth of parts that the dealer was going to have to buy, but technically they weren't returnable because they couldn't process a return with the manufacturer, because the manufacturer shuts down on the 15th and they're closed for the holidays. So what I did is I alerted them and I said, listen, this is going to be an issue unless you get this figured out, and one of you is going to end up eating it if you don't get the manufacturer to jump in. So we were able to kind of avoid that $45,000 thing, and they were both very happy about that, obviously. But we were able to get the factory, because the factory really wanted this sale to happen. So they basically sat down and said, hey, this deal's not going to happen unless you take these parts back and give us a credit form. So they had to make a special exception. But once the deal's done and the horse has left the stable, very seldom is the manufacturer going to do that. They're going to say, well, it's up to you. Not sure you own it now. So those are some situations and a lot of things that people don't think about. And then also at the closing table, certain parts become an issue and they start saying, well, we're not obligated to buy this. Well, yes, you technically are. No, you're not. And that's when I make myself available, rather than having several attorneys around the table discussing this at crazy hourly rates on something that may not really even have a value. So usually I can get right to the bottom of those things quickly and save everyone a lot of time, and that certainly helps a lot. But yeah, making sure the department is clean and ready to go for that process is definitely can make the difference on a sale as well.
Yeah. So for selling dealers, how do you advise them on some of these best practices? You know, having it clean, cleaning it up in advance, but can you get a little bit more specific if they were working with you specifically on what to do?
Yeah, well, obviously the sooner the better. There's kind of a big thing in our world where they say, oh, I got to get ready for inventory. And of course, we're always saying, well, you should always be ready for inventory, because that means that your inventory is where it's supposed to be and you're operating at the most efficiency. But that doesn't always play out that way. So the cycle counting is huge. I mean, that fixes a lot of things. So you want to be cycle counting. When I say cycle counting, basically what they're doing is they're taking whether it's one bin location a day or several or whatever and saying, okay, we're going to check the on hands on these and make sure everything's good and check those parts. And if there's any adjustments that we need to make, they do it so that when we come in, we're not sitting there having to go through all of that. Because there's two things that slow down an inventory. It's a write-in, which is a part that's in the wrong location. And then checking variances, which are the parts that have a different quantity on hand than what the system says. So we check those in three reiterations, you know, as we go through the inventory before we finalize it. But the more of those there are, the longer it takes, obviously. So cycle counting is the one thing that fixes that. The other thing is just cleaning it up from a visual standpoint. You know, if you have piles of stuff on the floor, that's not a good thing. That means that who knows what that's for. You want to get your dirty cores sent back. Those are things that are important, because chances are, once that deal closes, your dealer code is shut off and you can no longer return those dirty cores, which a lot of times those do not transfer to the buyer. In that case, that can be several thousand dollars. I mean, tens of thousands of dollars, especially if the manufacturer had just recently had a run on recalls of engines, which happens quite often, different manufacturers. And that can be, I've been in a dealership where there's been $150,000 worth of dirty cores sitting there. And if they can't return those after the fact because their dealer code shut off, they're eating it. So there's a lot of little things that they can do, but those are the kind of the main things, just to getting it cleaned up from that standpoint. Also removing any like named things from the inventory. So let's say it's Smith Motors and they have t-shirts in the inventory that say Smith Motors and all that kind of stuff. Those are branded. Those aren't going to transfer in the sales. So just get them out of the inventory now so that you're not dealing with that at time of inventory. But we do typically, so when we go through an inventory, we're looking for those special branded items that and we remove those at the time of inventory. And then things that are also look like they're open packages or damaged parts or part not a full thing, or even like tires. A lot of times dealers will take tires off because they'll swap them out from a new car because they put new tires on it, different ones. And they'll put those in the inventory. Well, those are not things that are going to sell and transfer in a sale because they're technically used. So just all that, the more type of getting that stuff straightened out beforehand so you're not dealing with it at time of inventory makes everything a lot smoother.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, big news in the automotive industry not long ago was the CDK outage. And how do you've shared some strategies about handling system outages like this and CDK downtime. There could be preparation for whatever could be next. What are some habits you would ask dealers to maybe start working on now before the next possible disruption?
Yeah, well, it's always important to have I mentioned it in the very beginning, the card file system and all those kinds of things. Obviously, you're not going to have a card file system on hand, but the term inventory pad, which is a big term in our world, comes from just that. They used to have a pad listing of the inventory at the counter, and they had a master pad that they would look up the parts and they would have the location and that's what they used. And so that term kind of carried on with it. And today that pad really resides in the computer system. But one of the things that's important is to have a daily download, if you will. You can set it up to download to an Excel or any one of the DMSs should have it where you automate the report. And you get as many fields on that as possible, including the cost, the part number, the retail, the pricing, the core value, if there is one on it, all the multiple bin locations that you may have it in, all of the data that you can, the last sale date, all that data that you can, which is easy to do. You build it into a report. And you just set it up to run nightly and store it somewhere. And when you have that, you're not dead in the water. You've got a full listing of your parts. And you basically just go back to the way it used to be, which is, oh, where's this part at? Let's see. Do we have it? You look it up. Yes, we do. Oh, it's in this bin location. You go get it. So you really aren't, you know, because at that point, the people who were able to react quickly and have things like that, like all the dealers that were on our PartsRec program, they have all that data in our PartsRec program. So they were actually working off of our system because they could search the part number and all the transactions and it would tell you everything they needed to know about it. So they didn't really miss a beat. And then, of course, everyone was going to handwritten repair orders and parts invoices and things. And that makes it possible. But without that data, I mean, you don't know where those parts are. You can't pull them. You may know where some of them are, but that's one thing that I would say is probably the biggest thing that we had and that we were able to do for our dealers. We also were able to, because we run those type of reports when we do physical inventories. So all of our dealers that we had done their inventory 6 months prior to that, we basically reached out to all of them. And we said, hey, listen, here's this file. Hopefully it helps. if you want, let us know and we'll give you the most recent one, because a lot of times you're not moving the location of parts necessarily. So at least they had that. They knew where they were at in their warehouse as the, and they could look them up and they had the other cost and so forth. But yeah, that's really my, I think the takeaways are that was probably the biggest thing that could really hurt a parts department is just not having some type of a recent file that gives you the most important information you need to continue business.
Going back to buy-sell transactions from the buyer's perspective in working with them, what advice do you give in terms of if they're looking at an acquisition, just how to protect themselves when they're writing up the, they're negotiating the deal and the parts part of the asset purchase agreement? Are there things that you recommend so they're not buying obsolescence in parts? Is it a certain amount of time? And maybe if you could just give us your 2 cents on that.
Yeah, there's a there, first of all, the bottom line is that as a buyer, they, you don't want to buy anything that's worthless. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. You want to buy current parts, and just because they might be current on a price, to, you know, because they're a current part number that the manufacturer says is a current part, doesn't mean that you've had any demand for it. You know, that there's two things, and really, you only want to be stocking parts that you have a demand for. So we basically, one of the things that I recommend is that number one, you don't buy any obsolete parts, and typically the scenario is how many months it's been since the part has been sold. So that's usually the driving indicator of okay, and standard is 12 months no sale. However, if you're like a GM dealer and you're on RIM, you can't return a part under that program until it hits 15 or 16 months no sale. So I've had several GM deals that have had to kind of be renegotiated because they put 12 months in there. They didn't really understand the parts side of it. And then all of a sudden, they've got all these parts that are technically obsolete, but they are qualifying for a RIM return. And so on those, in those particular situations, you should be putting in there 15 months, not 12 months. And again, the idea is that it's fair for both parties. You, the buyer should be buying parts that they're going to use in the normal course of business, and they're not going to be creating any, taking on any liability. And the seller should understand that, and usually they do, but they're always, you know, they're always trying to get as much across the finish line as they can. And especially for me, sometimes I'm just shaking my head because I'm looking at these multiples they're paying on Blue Sky, and then they're squabbling over $1,000 worth of parts. Kind of mind-boggling sometimes. But yeah, the biggest thing is months no sale, and then also days supply, which I very rarely see in an agreement, is your days supply. So I'll give you an example. So I did a buy-sell on a Chrysler dealership in Colorado one time. And they had a shop that did these, they were building like $150,000 Jeeps where they were customizing them and they were putting the Viper engines in them and thinking this was a ways back. So they had 12 of these Viper engines in stock, and they had just recently sold, they hadn't sold them for a while because the business had, something happened in that side of the business, a manager left or whatever, and that business kind of was falling apart, and the Jeep customization side of it. And so they were sitting on, it's like 10 or 12 of these engines, and they weren't cheap. And so they had sold one about a month before the inventory, a month before the closing. So all of a sudden, and the clause was, as long as it's been sold in the past, as long as they've had a sale in the past 12 months. Well, that took all those engines. Now they have, now they're sitting on 9 more of these engines, and there's no demand for it. There's no, you know, they're sitting on them. I mean, obviously they could salvage their way out of them at some point, but they were taking that on, and there was nothing they could do about it. And so they had to work their way out. They had to buy those engines, and they had to kind of work their way out of it. But that's a scenario where a day's supply clause in there would have worked, that you don't have any more than a 60-day supply of any part. Or if I was buying it, that's what I would want. Some people say, well, a one-year supply. Because you do have situations where dealers will buy bulk of, say, oil filters, things like that. They'll buy several months worth because they're getting a deal on it, and they'll just stock it. And so obviously those things could kind of get in there. But yeah, it's important to look at both of those factors, months no sale. And a lot of times people say, well, wait a minute, that part was just purchased. How could it be 12 months old? Well, you may have just bought it. It was a special order, but a special order that never got filled is what happens, which that's the number one creator of obsolete parts is special order parts that never end up being sold, which is a whole nother discussion. But that part, just because they received it into their inventory 30 days ago, if they haven't had a sale on it, they're out. So, I mean, that's kind of another point for a selling dealer is go through all your special orders, make sure those are returned if they haven't been filled, because you're going to eat those.
Yeah, that's a great point about the day supply.
Yeah, I very rarely see it. I mean, I've seen it maybe in 2% of the agreements that I've ever read.
I've never heard that before, but I like the suggestion for sure.
Yeah, and it's just kind of a safety catch. You don't want to, you know, because that can also, like I was saying, dealers are going to have more than a 60-day of supply of some parts, especially during like shortages or something like that. They hear about it and they're like, oh, these parts are going to get hard to get, so let's buy up on it. If it's a recall, that kind of thing, they'll buy quite a bit just to get the soap. In those types of scenarios, just know those things going into it. And those are the kinds of things to be communicating with the parts manager when they're drafting a buy sell. Now, unfortunately, the conundrum is this. Most dealers, when they're negotiating their buy sell agreement, they're not cluing in their parts manager. So that becomes difficult, because usually the parts manager is the only one that really can speak to that and speak positive, which I tell all my clients that I have annual inventories for, we guarantee them that we will accommodate their buy-sell inventory. So regardless of when it is, we make sure that we will accommodate that. So they're not running around trying to do that. But with that, I also say, hey, before you get your final agreement done, shoot it over to me. Let me take a look at it so that I can just shoot some holes, because I don't need to, I can do one download of their data and see any issues that they may have. So whether that's the buyer or the seller, I can kind of work that out beforehand.
Mark, I get asked often about, what do I do with my obsolete parts? Being the entrepreneur that you are, have you heard any great ways of dealing with obsolete parts? I've had everything from donate them to your local tech school to put them all on eBay, hire a college student to put them all online and try to sell them. Have you heard any other unique ways of ridding yourself of that?
So it's been a problem for years. And ironically, before I built our Parts Rec program, I actually had built a obsolete parts program. The problem was getting the data connected. And in that time, we built the program, and basically it was alerting dealers to allowing them kind of a parts trading platform one part at a time. But our data connections through all those lawsuits that were going on at the time with the different DMSs, data kind of became difficult to get. So we tabled it and actually we're bringing it back out this year. And what it does is just sell a part, you know, at a time. It identifies that automatically. So one of the challenges that you have and that everyone's had over the years is, how much time does it take to market those parts? What's your time, your investment of time versus what you're getting back, and having to decide, gee, is there really a market for this? And problem is there's really no way to know that other than just putting it out there, putting the parts. Everyone says, oh, get it on eBay, we'll sell it on eBay. Well, that takes a lot of time to manage that. And so you start weighing, okay, what are we getting out of it? And usually nobody tracks that data. So it's really hard to say, was it worth it or not? Then you have a number of years back, we actually used to have, we had a little bit of a side business going on. It was a decent revenue stream, but we would broker parts between dealers. So one dealer would have return credits that they weren't using because they were just a really well-oiled machine, usually a big wholesale operation. They're earning these return credits, but they don't have any obsolescence to return. So we would have another dealer that had parts that the obsolescence, and we'd say, okay, well, we've got a dealer that'll buy those for 50 cents on the dollar. So they would take those, and then they would end up returning them, either using them, because one dealer's obsolescence could be another dealer's stocking items, just based on things, but not always. But the dealer that had them, and then most of those parts would end up returned back to the manufacturer for full value. And so that went on for a number of years, and that was a great deal, not a good deal for the factories. So they caught on and really started trying to implement policies, and then they had policies in place, but they couldn't really monitor it. So then, and then with time, they really shut that down, and with technology and so forth, they were able to do that. So that doesn't really happen anymore. So you end up having, there are some other services out there that buy it back in bulk. But again, by the time it's all said and done, you're getting maybe 10 cents on the dollar, and you've spent a bunch of time on it. So it becomes very difficult. And that's like I said, it's a right now, I would say your donation route is going to be your best. Take the tax write-off. And that's going to be your best, because you usually it doesn't require too much labor to give stuff away. So that would be my recommendation. And the hard part is obsolescence is deciphering. There are some nuggets in those parts. You know, there are some obsolete parts that just haven't sold, but they're expensive and there has been demand on it. So how do you put those two together? And that's where our program kind of comes into play and does it seamlessly behind the scenes. And also, if a dealer comes to, like, I my parts manager came to me one time and said, here, I want to write off all these parts. I'm like, well, how do you know they're all obsolete? How do you know there's no demand anymore? He goes, well, how am I going to do that? I'm like, well, I don't know. That's a good question. You know, has there been demand out there? And so that's one of the things that we've focused on too, is being able to identify those parts. If you want to write off some obsolescence, here you go. Run those parts through the system, and it'll tell you if there's been any demand whatsoever throughout an entire network. That's good data. You say no, okay, get rid of those, go donate them. Okay, let's get these up on the market and try to sell them at a discount. So it's a tough animal, really is. But we feel that we've got a good solution to it. So we'll see.
With all the technology in the business and all areas of the car business, what do you see as the biggest opportunities or risks in the parts department specifically in the next, call it 5 to 10 years?
So I would say the biggest risks are, I mean, the risks remain the same. You have roughly anywhere from 500,000 on average, it's about a little over 500,000 is the average inventory size in the country. The departments are vulnerable. There's just, they all are. They're extremely vulnerable just because there's very little oversight. And so probably my biggest thing that I try to preach to dealers and general managers is understand parts. You know, it's not a difficult thing to get your head around, but you've got to give it some time, because it's such a large investment and it plays a big part in your service department, which, you know, it can make the difference. If you've got a bad parts department and a tech is waiting for 15 minutes at the counter, you know, at $200 an hour, add that up on times how many ROs, times how many mechanics. That's huge. And that happens because parts are in the wrong place. The department's not organized. It's not quick. They don't have parts runners set up, things like that. So those are areas where if they just had the knowledge and just gave it a little time, that they could and really tried to learn it and went down to the department. You could ask the average owner or general manager, when was the last time you went into the parts department? I don't know, 10 years ago when I wanted one of those t-shirts maybe. And so I understand it's not very exciting and it's probably the least sexy part of the business, but there's a lot that plays around it. And a lot can, when you look at it, if they dialed in their parts department, like they dial in used cars. So really it's just the vulnerability that you have because of the lack of accountability in the department. The interesting thing is the parts manager's position in the dealership is the position with the most longevity of any other position. And as much as I would like to say it's because all parts managers are just really good, solid people, which most of them are, it's really because they're never challenged on anything. There's no accountability. They kind of do what they want to do. And so as long as they don't create any waves, then they're just left back there to do their thing. And that's about it. And so if general managers and owners kind of dug in a bit and started doing some digging and learning the, you know, it's okay that they don't know anything about it, but they can certainly learn about it. And they just have to be vulnerable. And from that, it's amazing what they'll learn. But that vulnerability is huge. I mean, I've had a lot of theft issues that I've uncovered over the years. And the problem is the theft, when it happens, it's not a little bit, it's a lot. The smallest theft amount I've ever had was about $250,000, the smallest. So, because what happens is they know what to do and they're able to do it over a long period of time and they can cover their tracks. I mean, I hate to say it, but I mean, if I wanted to be a dishonest person, I'd go get a parts manager's job and I could steal from just about any one of my clients over time and go completely undetected. So it's a huge vulnerability, huge, huge. So, and it's not just, oh, I've only got $250,000 in parts. Well, it doesn't matter. It's not like they're walking away with $250,000. They're stealing it like 1,000 at a time over several months. That's what I think is the biggest challenge. And it really doesn't change. Technology is getting better, allowing you to have access to the data. So it's really important that you get that. And when you do replace that manager, that parts manager, the joke in the industry is, you know, when you ask a parts manager, oh, how did you get your job? Oh, I was the counterman. I was the closest one to the general manager when the last manager got fired. So you can't just put somebody in that position and expect them to know it. You need to invest in them if that's going to be the right person. And sending them to, you know, a 3-day course on parts is not going to make them capable, because what happens is they usually have it in a nice place where they either Las Vegas or whatever, and they get everybody there, and then the first day they get into it and they give them their class binder or the notes or whatever they're giving them, and then they go hardcore that day, and then that night everybody goes out and has a big time, and the next day the class is like half awake, half asleep, and they're getting through, and then the third day really is, oh, hey, I got to catch my plane. And it just kind of wraps it up. And then everybody leaves with their binder and they go back to the dealership and they put it on the shelf and it collects dust and they never open it again. So training is not really just a 2-day course. It's or a 3-day course. It has to be ongoing and pertinent to your store. So that's important as well. So that's kind of my two cents on that.
So dealers visit your parts departments often, dig into the details and challenge your parts manager. That's what I got out of that.
Yeah, exactly. And learn it. And don't be afraid. And I think that's where a lot of the problem comes in, is they just don't know and they don't want to expose that they don't know. So just find there's places you can get that information. Like I said, with my dealers, I always tell them, I'm like, listen, call me. If you have a question about something, call me. I'll be happy to take it. 2-minute phone call to explain it to you. And then if you go to your parts manager and you say, okay, this is this, and they come back and they say, well, this is what he told me, but I don't really understand it. I'm like, okay, well, this is what he told you, and this is how you need to go back at him with it. So it's a little bit of coaching and marriage counseling, if you will, I guess, but it needs to be done. There's no question. It's long overdue.
Mark, this has been very insightful and very practical advice. Thank you so much for touching on some of those buy-sell transaction specific examples. I thought those were really helpful and just overall very good advice for dealers when it comes to their parts department. So I appreciate that. If anyone in our audience or any dealers would like to reach out and get in touch with you or learn more about Total Dealer Solutions, how would they do so?
They can send me an email to mark@tdsteam.com, or they can call me as well. I mean, I kind of have an open line to my clients and a lot of people. So even if I don't answer, they can leave a message. But my cell phone number is 954-410-6368.
Perfect. Thanks again, Mark.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Driving Performance. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review. If you're considering buying or selling an automotive dealership, reach out to us at performancebrokerageservices.com or send an email to info@performancebrokerageservices.com.